Welcome to VOA Asia Weekend. In the next hour, we'll recap and highlight the stories that made headlines through the week. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Last week, President Trump announced that North Korea had been put back on the U.S. list of state sponsors of terrorism.
In addition to threatening the world by nuclear devastation, North Korea has repeatedly supported acts of international terrorism.
The U.S. made a decision to label what has been happening in Myanmar as ethnic cleansing. The U.S. military attacked drug-making facilities that the commander said have been funding the Taliban.
The other external actors who meddle in Afghanistan for their own gain must also realize that they have picked the wrong side.
That and a whole lot more on this edition of VOA Asia Weekend. South Korea and Japan Tuesday welcomed the U.S. announcement that it was putting North Korea back on its list of state sponsors of terrorism, a move, as South Korean Foreign Ministry spokesman said, was part of the international effort to denuclearize Pyongyang peacefully. A Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman described the situation as being complicated and sensitive and called on all parties to return to the correct path of negotiation, dialogue, and consultation. President Donald Trump, in making the announcement from the White House, said reinstating North Korea on the list after being removed in 2008 should have been done a long time ago.
In addition to threatening the world by nuclear devastation, North Korea has repeatedly supported acts of international terrorism, including assassinations on foreign soil. This designation will impose further sanctions and penalties on North Korea and related persons, and supports our maximum pressure campaign to isolate the murderous regime that you've all been reading about and in some cases writing about. Tomorrow, the Treasury Department will be announcing an additional sanction, and a very large one, on North Korea, and this will be going on over the next 2 weeks. It'll be the highest level of sanctions by the time it's finished over a two-week period. The North Korean regime must be lawful. It must end its unlawful nuclear and ballistic missile development, and cease all support for international terrorism, which it is not doing.
The North was first put on the terrorism list following the downing of a Korean Air passenger jet in 1987 with a loss of 115 lives. It was taken off by the Bush administration as the North began implementing a nuclear disarmament agreement. Critics contend it will only incite North Korea to engage in provocative behavior, undercut efforts to get China's cooperation in reining in Pyongyang, and do little to encourage dialogue. VOA's Victor Beatty asked Tufts University Assistant Professor of Korean Studies Sung Yoon Lee if he believes it is a good move.
Yes, because there's been a very strong movement within Congress to get the administration to relist North Korea as a state sponsor of terrorism. You know, Trump's announcement during this week of a major holiday in the United States, with Thanksgiving Day just looming, it gives North Korea the excuse to conduct another major weapons test and then to deflect blame onto the United States, to do something North Korea would have done anyway and lay the blame on the U.S. North Korea will say this is a provocation, it's unacceptable. But the question is, does this act have beyond symbolic opprobrium? Does it have real practical financial costs? And I would say decidedly yes.
So there is an upside to this argument?
Yes, there is. First of all, North Korea never should have been taken off the list when it was during the Bush administration in 2008. That removal of North Korea from the list was in return for Pyongyang's illusory promise of denuclearization and full compliance with inspections requirements. We know none of that has come into fruition. What are the practical benefits of relisting North Korea? Well, from now, any bank that seeks to process dollar transactions using U.S. dollar denominations on behalf of a North Korean entity is now required to apply for a Treasury Department license. It adds an added layer of deterrence, whereas before the relisting, a bank that may be suspicious that this is a shady deal with North Korea will most likely blithely just go on and do it, ignore it, and will probably be able to fly under the radar. Now, if a bank is found to have willfully violated U.S. laws, then conceivably the United States will at some point levy a major fine on that bank on the scale of BNP Paribas, the biggest French bank, which was fined almost $9 billion for violating this kind of general licensing requirements with respect to Iran, Sudan, and Cuba. So, you know, it's not merely symbolic. It has real financial costs on North Korea's business partners. Moreover, any public corporation that has investments in North Korea are now required to disclose their investments in public filings. What does that do? Probably not much in the short term, but since there is so much attention, world opinion and attention on North Korea today, it's not inconceivable that you might see movements toward divestiture from those companies. Where would we see that kind of movement? Well, on college campuses, within NGOs, because we saw exactly that with respect to South Africa and apartheid.
Sun Yun Lee said the relisting of Pyongyang will make Chinese banks and state-owned enterprises more careful and circumspect in their business dealings with North Korea. Chinese envoy Sung Tao ended a four-day trip to North Korea Monday, a visit some thought might include a stern warning from President Xi Jinping over nuclear tensions. One of the top international stories this day comes from the African nation of Zimbabwe, where that country's longtime president, Robert Mugabe, has ignored a Monday noon deadline to either step down or face impeachment. Mugabe made clear in a televised speech Sunday that he did not intend to resign. There are reports circulating that China might have been involved in the decision to take Mugabe out of office. We welcome to VOA Asia Yun Sun, senior associate of the East Asia program at the Washington-based Stinson Center. Her expertise is in China foreign policy, and the background noise you will hear is because she is waiting for a flight at the airport. Yun, thanks so much for being with us. First of all, do you believe those reports of Chinese involvement? And if you do, can you explain what might have occurred here?
Well, the timing is really intriguing because the military leader of Zimbabwe visited China a few days before the coup in Zimbabwe, before the political turmoil started. So it automatically raises the question that when he was in Beijing and when he was meeting with Chinese military leaders and political leaders, what message did the Zimbabwe military leader convey to the Chinese? We know that China and Zimbabwe have had long-standing political and economic ties, and China has developed concerns about Zimbabwe's domestic policy, given the instability and the economic chaos that the Mugabe government has created inside his country. So I don't believe that China was explicitly discussing the political plan, the coup plan of the military leaders of Zimbabwe when he was in Beijing, because that would put China in a very vulnerable position, and it will put China's foreign policy principle of non-interference under dramatic scrutiny and challenge internationally. And that's not in China's interest. It also doesn't give China the deniability of any involvement in case this political coup does not succeed. So I believe that China does have concern about Mugabe's policy, and China has lobbied for Mugabe to change his policy. However, for China to be actively involved or support of a coup, I think that goes too far.
Well, has China said anything dealing with this whatsoever?
After the political turmoil started, the Chinese position is we want Zimbabwe to be peaceful and to be stable. We don't support a civil war. And we look forward to work with the Zimbabwe government regardless of who the leader will be.
Now, China has become a major trading partner with Zimbabwe. What do you think has happened? Why has the tenure of Mugabe come to a point or reached a point where China might not be happy with it?
Well, it's primarily because of the economic policy of the Mugabe government. China's interest in Zimbabwe has been one on trade, like you pointed out. The other one is Chinese investment in the natural resources sectors inside Zimbabwe. Well, we also know that Mugabe has gone back and forth on the issue of naturalization of foreign investment and also the indigenization of foreign projects. For example, the diamond mines that the Chinese have invested in was going to be indigenized, meaning that the Zimbabwean government was going to naturalize the Chinese mines that the Chinese invested in. And that automatically raised the question that what does the political solidarity really translate into? If Mugabe was perceiving China as a foreign exploiter of the Zimbabwean economy, that put his policy and China's policy into direct conflict and in a collision course. So that issue has been a main sore spot between Beijing and Mugabe.
How involved is China with the local economy of Zimbabwe?
Well, given the Western sanction on Zimbabwe and given the lack of alternatives, I would say that the Chinese are pretty deeply involved in the local economy. We just talked about the natural resources sector. The export of Chinese products in Zimbabwe is also pretty significant. Well, Zimbabwe is one of China's largest economic partners coming to the African continent.
Bangladesh is in negotiations with Myanmar aimed at a deal to repatriate Rohingya refugees. More than 600,000 refugees have entered Bangladesh since August. Last week, the Bangladeshi foreign minister traveled across the border to Myanmar. A statement attributed to Abul Hassan Mahmoud Ali said Bangladesh and Myanmar are in the process of negotiation for a bilateral agreement for repatriation of displaced people and expect to form a joint working group to facilitate the repatriation. More than 600,000 Muslim Rohingya have fled to neighboring Bangladesh since late August, driven out by a military clearance operation in Buddhist-majority Myanmar's Rakhine State, a situation that has caused an international outcry. Last week, a United Nations General Assembly committee called on Myanmar to end military operations that have led to the systemic violation and abuse of human rights of Rohingya Muslims, said the statement. The move revived a UN resolution that was dropped last year due to Myanmar's progress on human rights. The announcement of the communication between Bangladesh and Myanmar came the same day EU Foreign Policy Chief Federica Mogherini and other foreign ministers visited Rohingya refugee camps in Bangladesh before flying to Myanmar for a meeting on the crisis. Mogherini expressed her feeling that the negotiating table is the place to reach an agreement to end the situation.
More than putting pressure, I would say that it's our approach has always been and will continue to be to offer a negotiating space, encourage the taking care of this situation that is not going to disappear. So it is, I think, a responsibility of the authorities to find solutions. And again, the international community has indicated some of the solutions, especially the Kofi Annan plan that San Suu Kyi has committed to implement. And we are there to support her in doing this.
After touring the Katupalang refugee camp and speaking to Rohingya women there, Mogherini also called for understanding of Aung San Suu Kyi's young democratic government.
You can ask different people around the world if they trust the leadership. The point is that we have to deal with what is there. And I would also have to add that, yes, there is a responsibility of the current leadership. There is also the difficult situation of a young democracy that just a few years ago entered a complicated process itself. And I believe that we have to understand the complexity of this situation. And again, life and politics is never completely black or white. It's about helping processes to develop the right direction.
As for the attitude of many of those in the Bangladesh refugee camp, Swedish Foreign Minister Margot Wallström, another member of the EU delegation, said that many had expressed a demand to Mogherini.
Federico also asked them, what do you want? Do you want to return? And they said, yes, we want to return, but with statehoodship and with also safety, knowing that we can feel secure.
Rohingyas have been denied citizenship in Myanmar, where many Buddhists regard them as illegal immigrants from Bangladesh. Top UN officials have denounced the violence as a classic case of ethnic cleansing. The Myanmar government has denied those allegations. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said Wednesday that violence in Myanmar's Rakhine State targeting Muslim Rohingya does qualify as ethnic cleansing. Tillerson said in a written statement, after a careful and thorough analysis of available facts, it is clear that the situation in northern Rakhine State constitutes ethnic cleansing against the Rohingya. VOA Asia's David Byrd had more on the decision.
Secretary of State Rex Tillerson has said that the crisis in Rakhine State in Myanmar has become ethnic cleansing of Rohingya Muslims. What does that term mean, and how will it affect the United States' response to the new democracy in Myanmar? To discuss that, I'm joined by foreign policy editor Aru Pandey. Aru, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, the term ethnic cleansing, first of all, just for people who don't know, can you define that in is what it is? Is it a legal term or is it a diplomatic term? What exactly is it?
Well, it's really not. It's not a legal term. As a State Department official told reporters today, it's not defined in the context of either international law or domestic law, which is very important. So basically, the term doesn't really have any legal implications. It's not like genocide or crimes against humanity, which both of those terms carry international legal consequences. That said, the reason that this is so important is because the United States and Tillerson has been pressed on taking a stand on this issue. We've heard strong statements, but the United Nations, U.S. lawmakers, you name it, have been calling this ethnic cleansing for several weeks now. And as late as last week, when Tillerson was in Myanmar, meeting with leaders there, he was asked, are you going to call this ethnic cleansing? And he said, well, we're still looking at it. So yes, it's important. It's an important statement to make that yes, the United States has declared it that. In terms of the consequences or the legal implications, there are not.
This comes at a time when some folks on Capitol Hill are considering imposing or reimposing sanctions against Myanmar, doesn't it?
Right. And that's the key here. When State Department officials were asked about this today at a briefing as to what this means, what's the point of this? They said this will put additional pressure on Myanmar, on the military forces there, and also they called for a probe and investigation to what's going on. The sanctions part in the statement today, Tillerson also said he mentioned the possibility of targeted sanctions, and that's important. Lawmakers on Capitol Hill have called for sanctions. There's currently legislation that is under consideration to bring sanctions against Myanmar for what they call atrocities that are going on there. But Tillerson and the State Department have been quite clear they don't want to see broad sanctions against Myanmar and the government. What they would rather see, what they would rather consider, or lawmakers consider, are targeted sanctions against individuals.
Because sanctions, the United States for a long time had sanctions against the former ruling military junta in Myanmar, and now that they are a nascent democracy, they're kind of putting their democracy together. We don't want to, as I understand it, the Secretary is saying they don't want to impose broad sanctions that would hurt efforts to form a democratic government.
Right, and that was also mentioned in the sense that the United States wants to support this, like you said, this new civilian government, this new transition, and they fear that if they put broad sanctions on Myanmar, it'll take that country back to what it was under that military rule. So they don't want to do that. They want to give Myanmar the space, and also they don't want to affect its economy in that way, because that is key to the growth of that country and the government. And so they want to make sure that they give them that space to grow economically, and they fear that broad sanctions, in a sense punishing Myanmar, would take that country back to where it was before 18 months ago, 2 years ago.
VOA foreign policy editor Aru Pandey. Aru, thank you.
Thank you.
Ahead on VOA Asia Weekend, the U.S. military launches airstrikes on Afghanistan drug-making laboratories. Stay with us. The Indian LGBT community's battle to scrap a colonial-era law that criminalizes gay sex took a tortuous route last week. Scrapped in 2009, it was reinstated in 2013 by the Supreme Court, dealing a massive blow to gay rights. But as Anjana Pasricha reported from New Delhi, there is renewed optimism that a recent Supreme Court ruling paved the way to overturn the law, which the top court is due to review.
The beat of drums was louder, the chanting and dancing more exuberant, as the gay community marched at the annual Queer Pride Parade in the Indian capital this week. The reason? A recent landmark judgment by the Supreme Court, which declared privacy is a fundamental right that must protect, among other things, sexual orientation. Anjali Gopalan, founder of NAS Foundation, which is at the forefront of the legal battle for gay rights, says the judgment will have an important bearing when the Supreme Court reviews the archaic law called Section 377.
Five out of the nine judges, because that was a nine judgment, actually questioned the validity of 377. So to me, that's amazing. I feel a little easier after the privacy judgment.
Manak Matiani was heartened on hearing the top court say that some matters are not the business of the government.
And in this case, where it is consensual, where it is something that you are not doing to harm anybody else, it is a private matter and that you have the right to decide who you are, how you will live your life. That made us very hopeful.
There is opposition to gay rights from some Hindu, Muslim and Christian religious groups on the grounds of public morality. They say Indian society frowns upon homosexuality but have not reacted yet to the court ruling. The 156-year-old law, which makes gay sex punishable with up to 10 years in prison, is seldom enforced, and many belonging to the well-off sections like Matiani live openly as gays. But it exposes those less privileged to harassment. Pobir Hazara has found acceptance at the NAS Foundation where he works as a cook, but that is not the case in public spaces.
When I meet friends in a park on a holiday to relax, to have a drink, the police waves us away. They say you will create a nuisance and threaten to detain us if we don't leave.
Gopalan says the lack of rights has a range of serious implications for the community.
If someone from the LGBT community, for example, is raped, it's really difficult for them to go and register a case because Section 377 is in place, because they're not seen as part of society, right? So therefore, if we have a law which protects them, at least they have that recourse.
That is why Matiani says the parade was more than a celebration of gay pride.
It's important to remember that the march is still a protest. It is still, out there to say that, rights are not given to people.
That is what participants are hoping to get. Legal protection for their sexual orientation, a right now taken for granted in most democratic countries. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
You're listening to VOA Asia Weekend. 11 countries meeting at the APEC summit in Da Nang, Vietnam, agreed that last week to seek a Trans-Pacific Free Trade Agreement despite the world's largest market, the United States, pulling out of the deal. Vietnam is expected to be one of the biggest beneficiaries of freer trade as it expands rapidly growing exports, including technology. VOA's Daniel Scherf visited Vietnam's largest technology company, FPT, and had an exclusive interview with its chairman in Da Nang.
Free trade and investment are driving Vietnam's economy, growing more than 6% per year, among the fastest four in Asia.
Actually, I think that's very important for Vietnam, not only open to the world, but also to improve the regulations for trading and manufacturing and make Vietnam more international.
Vietnam's largest technology company may get a boost from a free trade deal brokered at APEC meetings to replace the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
On the basis of the results of four rounds of negotiations, ministers over meetings in the last few days in Da Nang have agreed on some important contents, including an agreement of a new name for TPP with 11 members, the Comprehensive and Progressive Agreement for Trans-Pacific Partnership.
The revamped trade deal came after President Donald Trump withdrew the world's largest market, the United States, in favor of bilateral agreements.
I strongly believe at certain point, U.S. will be going to come back to this kind of strong commitment for growth. And I think that's going to be the way America go as the leaders in the world.
FPT says it has no intention of missing out on the global digital revolution.
Vietnam was late for last three industrial revolutions. And fourth industrial revolution is the only one, maybe is the kind of last chance for Vietnam to catching up with the world.
Vietnam's largest tech company with expanded facilities here at home is now looking more to markets in Asia. Daniel Scherf, VOA News, Da Nang.
Kyo Wong's family had everything in Vietnam. He owned a hotel, had a car, food, and money. But all of that changed with the end of the Vietnam War when Wong and his family fled to the United States. Eventually, he became a billionaire in his new country. As Elizabeth Lee tells us, when devastating floods hit California and Texas this year, Wong found a way to give back to his new home.
Music has a way of bringing comfort and normalcy. That's the case for retiree Sang Trang and his wife. Floodwaters forced them to flee their home more than 8 months ago.
This entire neighborhood was underwater. Most of the residents who live here are low-income immigrants from Vietnam and Latin America.
14,000 people in San Jose had to evacuate from the flood. But help came when San Jose's mayor received a phone call from Kyu Hoang.
He said, I'm in for $5 million. But his mandate was clear and it was perfect. It's exactly what we needed. No strings attached, but every dollar was going to go to the victims, and it did.
Hoang also donated $5 million to flood relief in Houston when Hurricane Harvey hit.
We have to be grateful to the United States of America, to the people who allow us to come into the country to be successful. So now this is the time we pay back.
Hoang's donation not only helped flood victims pay for temporary housing.
We also were able to use that funding for car donations, for car repairs, for household items.
Hoang's donation helped Trang buy another car so he can perform his music in his community. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, San Jose.
Despite 70 years of tense relations between India and Pakistan, the two countries share a passion for each other's movies, food, and fashion trends. Take the example of palazzos, a popular Pakistani type of pants that are all the rage now in India. VOA Urdu reporter Ritu Joshi is in Delhi, where she found the trend began after a new Indian TV channel started broadcasting Pakistani dramas.
There's something about this outfit that fascinates Indian fashionistas. These loose pants were known to only a few 3 years ago. Renowned Indian filmmaker and fashion designer Muzaffar Ali says, in fact, it is a purely Indian outfit.
I have seen people wearing this all my life, especially in the Lucknow and Awadh areas. It was worn by both men and women.
It used to be called izar, very stylish and trendy. It was made with lace and embroidery. Young Rekha in Muzaffar's film Umrao Jaan is also seen wearing the loose white pants.
The introduction of palazzos may date back now, but an Indian woman always teamed her kurta with either a churidar or a salwar, until palazzos from across the border showed up. Palazzos became extremely popular in India in 2014, when a private entertainment channel started airing Pakistani serials. In 2016, these serials were taken off air when relations between India and Pakistan became sour. But by then, palazzos had already made a place in women's hearts and closets.
Pakistani serials had hit off really well with the Indian audience. Their actresses were so beautiful, everyone wanted to look like them.
Inspiration may have come from across the border, but palazzos have now been woven into the Indian fabric. They have caught the fancy of new and young designers.
Be it a short kurti, be it a long kurti, I love to pair them with palazzos, heavy palazzos, printed palazzos. I try to put in all kind of palazzos.
They can go with top, with kurtis and with the suit also.
Office going ladies are also asking for them these days. And we already have them in every color and print. Gujarati bandes.
You never know about fashion. At any time it can change its course. But in India for the moment, it seems these stylish yet comfortable pieces of clothing are what everyone wants to wear. Ritul Joshi, VOA News, Delhi.
Immunotherapy is one of the newer ways the medical community is trying to fight cancer. Immunotherapy is a way to get the body's natural defenses to fight the disease. It has great promise and has documented results. But VOA's Kevin Enix explains it's not for everyone.
Dennis Lyon's skin cancer had mutated nearly a dozen times by the time he came to the Cancer Center at the University of California at San Diego.
When I came to UCSD, I had been to other major cancer centers in the country because I have a very rare cancer called basal cell carcinoma metastatic. And most of them did not have a lot to offer me in the way of treatments.
2 months later, he was in complete remission.
In my case, we haven't had new tumors in months and months. And everything that I have had has shrunk to the point of being non-existent in some cases.
Lyon is one of the lucky few that have kicked cancer by taking drugs called checkpoint inhibitors that use the body's immune system to fight cancer.
The basic thread that runs throughout the different approaches in immunotherapy is the idea of reactivating a patient's own immune system to fight their cancer.
Checkpoint inhibitors unmask cancer cells that can hide from disease-fighting antibodies, called T cells.
The tumor has found a way to shut off the immune system. And checkpoint inhibitors prevent that from happening.
When the T cells can see the cancer cell, they can attack it. But it does not work for everyone.
Over the past 6-7 years, we started to see these drugs actually come into clinical practice and make a real difference in the lives of some patients. And I'm going to underline the word some patients because it's still not enough patients. Unfortunately, the minority of patients respond to immunotherapy.
The drugs are expensive and come with side effects. In some cases, they caused cancer to grow out of control, or they can inspire T cells to indiscriminately attack healthy cells.
Take the brakes off that the cancer has put in place, and it goes after the cancer, well, that means it might go after something else as well.
UCSD doctors are creating genetic roadmaps of different cancers to see how they respond to immunotherapy drugs. This may allow the creation of targeted drugs for specific cancers. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
A U.S. Marine is being held by Japanese authorities on suspicion of negligence in driving while intoxicated in the death of a Japanese driver Sunday on Okinawa that could spark renewed tensions over the U.S. military presence on that southern island.
Oyeshogaimushou kara, Sainichi Beigun, oyabi
Japan's Chief Cabinet Secretary Yoshihide Suga said his government has expressed deep regret and submitted a stern representation to the U.S. military and embassy to make sure such accidents don't happen. He said provincial police in Okinawa have launched an investigation. In response, U.S. forces have banned until further notice the consumption of alcohol by all U.S. personnel in Japan. U.S. Ambassador William Hagerty expressed his condolences and offered an apology. A similar ban was imposed last year after a head-on collision involving a young military service member. No one was killed there, but it followed the case of a military contractor who pleaded guilty last week to raping a 20-year-old local woman who was found dead. He was found not guilty of murder. Grant Newsham, senior research fellow at the Japan Forum for Strategic Studies, told VOA's Victor Beatty such incidents have happened for years and are a serious distraction.
And not to mention just tragic, and there is nothing good one can say about it. There is no excuse for it. One hardly knows what to say, especially if you've been around this issue for a long time. The maddening inability of U.S. forces to completely eliminate these sorts of tragic accidents is an ongoing problem. The U.S. military does its best to try to minimize it, but all that does is offer some context. But it really, as I say, these are very hard to completely eliminate, but tragic accidents.
U.S. forces have been based in Japan, of course, since the end of the Second World War. Taken all together, what does this bode for the future of U.S.-Japan military relations?
This helps to be able to step back a bit and put these into the larger context of the U.S. presence in Japan. Japan gets the services of the world's most powerful military really in exchange for really some real estate and a pittance of a financial contribution. So there is really the national security angle here, and then there is always the local basing issue, the local communities that have to have bases around them. And this really is nothing new, nor is it unique for Japan. Once again, it's not to dismiss any of this, but it is to put it in a larger context. These sorts of incidents really do need to be eliminated if possible. That may not be realistic, however, given just human nature being what it is. And also it's worth noting that in other parts of Japan, say Yokosuka up near Tokyo, Sasebo and Kyushu, and Misawa up north where you have large U.S. Air Force base, and Yokota near Tokyo with a big Air Force base as well, that they also have similar incidents every now and then. But you have sort of a cushion there which can withstand these sorts of events and deal with them and then move on. And that's something that you don't find in Okinawa much. There really isn't this cushion. It's not to say there isn't support for the U.S. military presence, or at least tolerance of it in Okinawa by many, many Okinawans, perhaps even a majority. But you do have a vocal opposition that does make use of these sorts of incidents to put its anti-base, anti-military, really anti-Tokyo case across.
Grant Newsham said Okinawa benefits from massive Japanese government subsidies for the presence of U.S. forces and insisted the island is not a hotbed of anti-American sentiment. But he said the U.S. military has failed to keep up a community outreach program that seemed in recent years to have helped improve its image among the local population. Cambodia's Tonle Sap Lake, which lies in the center of the country, is home to hundreds of species of fish that provide the Southeast Asian nation with up to 60% of its protein. But the lake's rich fishery is at risk now because of overfishing, pollution, and hydroelectric dams. More from VOA's Amy Katz.
The Tonle Sap is a seasonal freshwater lake that shrinks and grows by thousands of kilometers with the seasons. It is home to hundreds of species of fish and yields as much as 300,000 tons of fish every year. But that is changing.
In the past, we would catch lots of fish using our nets, but now there are so many people fishing here that we are not catching much anymore. That means we are making far less fish paste than before. Yes, and now the water level is high again, but it smells really bad, and as I said, there is not as much fish as before.
The reasons why are common to many of the world's bodies of water.
overfishing is reducing fish stock, spawning grounds are disappearing, and hydroelectric dams stopping the natural migration of some fish species. And the problem could get worse.
There are plans to build more dams upstream in Laos. In Cambodia, we already have a dam. We are worried the electric dams will affect the fish migration and reproduction rates. The dams have also slowed down the rate of water flowing into the lake and affect the water quality in the Mekong River.
The problem is twofold, because not only are there fewer fish to feed Cambodians, but there are more people relying on fishing to make their living. And the lake is dying. In 2016, environmental groups named Tunli Sab the world's most threatened lake. Government agencies say they are doing what they can.
We are continuing to work with the fishermen in the region to try to fix the problems. We've had many meetings with the parties. Just this morning, we filed our latest report with the Ministry of Environment, and soon they will be discussing with us what we should do.
The fear is not only will there not be enough food, but in coming years, smaller catches will cause a migration crisis as thousands of people who make their living on the lake head to cities looking for work. For Kevin Enix, Amy Katz, VOA News.
An inquiry in Australia is recommending the closure of a youth detention center involved in an abuse scandal that shocked the nation. Images of inmates being mistreated, including one teenage boy who was restrained and placed in a spit hood, were shown last year. From Sydney, Phil Mercer had the story.
Last year, a TV documentary showed images of young detainees being tear-gassed and strip-searched in youth detention facilities in Australia's Northern Territory. The scandal prompted the authorities to set up a Royal Commission, the highest form of inquiry in Australia. Its final report contains more than 2,500 pages and demands sweeping changes to address the shocking and systemic failures in the territory's youth justice system. A teenage detainee told the investigating team that he'd been deprived of food, repeatedly strip-searched, and stopped from using a toilet during his detention. He said he was forced to defecate into a pillowcase. The report said that the system's failures had happened over many years and were known and ignored at the highest levels. Northern Territory Chief Minister Michael Gunner is promising to act on the proposals.
I am sorry of the stories that will live on in those children who are in our care, children that we have failed, because our youth justice and child protection systems are supposed to make our kids better, not break them.
The report calls for an end to detention for children aged under 14 in the Northern Territory, prohibiting the use of tear gas and force on child inmates, and a move away from punishment to therapy and rehabilitation. The Northern Territory's notorious Don Dale Youth Detention Centre, where much of the mistreatment of child inmates took place, should also be closed, the report says. Margaret White, one of the commissioners, says more humane alternative accommodation should take its place.
The point must be met that there will be some young people who must be kept in secure detention, either because of the extreme seriousness of the crimes that they commit or because of their own complex needs. And we've recommended a small, secure facility. We don't want any more than 12 beds in any one facility.
Most of the teenage inmates in the Northern Territory are Aboriginal Australians, who are significantly overrepresented in the justice system. The children who are tear-gassed have said they feared for their lives and still suffer disturbing flashbacks and nightmares. Lawyers said detaining children in isolation was also a clear violation of the United Nations Convention Against Torture. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
When it comes to cars, generally there are three options. There is gas, a gas battery hybrid, or a full electric car. But for a fourth option, some car companies are banking on hydrogen as the fuel of the future. VOA's Kevin Enix powered this report.
Toyota has been selling the Mirai since 2014. The car giant has only sold about 4,000 of these hydrogen fuel cell powered cars. But Toyota's chairman is convinced the fuel cell will be the technology that drives tomorrow's emission-free vehicles.
There are two main points we need to consider. First, how to realize a low-carbon society to create a society with less CO2 emissions. The second point is to ensure a stable energy supply for the future. In this light, hydrogen holds tremendous potential.
A fuel cell mixes hydrogen with the oxygen in the air to generate electricity that can power a motor. There is no exhaust gas. The only byproducts are electricity, heat, and water.
Hydrogen certainly has more convenience for users than electric cars. The driving range is longer, and it takes the same amount of time to fill up with hydrogen as it does to fill up with gasoline cars.
More convenient in theory, but in fact, there were only a handful of hydrogen gas stations in the United States, and they are much more expensive than electric or hybrid automobiles.
It seems possible that if it could be streamlined into a more affordable and mass-producible technology, then it might be able to catch on. But it's hard to say because our society is so deeply entrenched in what we already know, which is, you know, gasoline and electric.
Toyota says it wants to sell 30,000 hydrogen-powered cars a year by 2020. Its ultimate goal is to cut car emissions by 90% compared to 2010 levels by 2050. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
The U.S. military has launched airstrikes on drug-making laboratories in Afghanistan as part of a new joint strategy with Afghan forces to cut off funding for the Taliban. General John Nicholson, commander of U.S. and NATO forces in Afghanistan, said 10 drug labs were destroyed in a series of aerial bombardments in the poppy-rich southern province of Helmand, a Taliban stronghold, on Sunday night.
Our combined operations over the last 24 hours are a demonstration of our will to defeat terrorists and those who support them, especially in the narcotics networks. The release of the UN's Office of Drug and Crime report last week underscores the threat of narcotics in Afghanistan, and together we are addressing this threat. The strikes that were prosecuted last night will continue. And the neighbors, the other external actors who meddle in Afghanistan for their own gain, must also realize that they have picked the wrong side, the side of terrorists and criminals who harm all people, not just the Afghan people, but people in their own countries as well. This took weeks of preparation, and based on the new authorities that I've received in the last 90 days with the U.S. policy announcement, we started developing targets immediately. We took every precaution to ensure that we struck the highest payoff targets with great precision.
Nicholson said targeting the drug labs would hit the Taliban where it hurts and warned of more strikes to follow. He said, "We hit the labs where they turned poppy into heroin. We hit their storage facilities where they kept their final products, where they stockpiled their money and their command and control." He noted that 400 or 500 drug labs active are across the country. The Taliban profits from the illegal drug trade by taxing poppy farmers and traffickers across the war-torn country, pocketing an estimated $200 million a year, according to official data. It was the first time an American F-22 stealth fighter had conducted an airstrike in Afghanistan, and Nicholson noted that the U.S. Air Force now has more air power at its disposal as operations against the Islamic State group in Iraq and Syria taper down. Taliban issued a statement denying the existence of the drug-making facilities. The U.S.-Afghanistan operation comes around 3,000 additional American troops promised by President Trump are deployed to help train and assist beleaguered Afghan security forces who have been struggling to beat back Taliban and Islamic State insurgents. The U.N. Office on Drugs and Crime warned last week that the significant levels of opium cultivation and trafficking in Afghanistan would fuel the insurgency and boost funding for militants. The area under poppy cultivation has expanded by 63% to a record of 328,000 hectares this year. topping the previous record of 224,000 hectares in 2014, with the number of poppy-growing provinces jumping to 24. Only 10 Afghan provinces are now considered to be poppy-free. Nicholson said the Taliban had evolved into a narco-insurgency fighting to protect earnings from drug trafficking, illegal mining, kidnapping, and murder for hire. While the Afghan military, with the help of NATO forces, is carrying out an operation to clear eastern Afghanistan of the militant Islamic State group, the day-to-day security of the area is now in the hands of a controversial local police force funded by the United States. VOA's Aisha Tanzim spent time with the Afghan local police in the Achin district of eastern Afghanistan, where this force is primarily fighting the Islamic State militants.
With their long hair and irregular fatigues, these men may look like militants, but they're villagers who work for the Afghan local police. In the Achin district of eastern Afghanistan, they often form the first line of defense if the Islamic State attacks a local village. This force is so effective because their families have been some of the first victims of the brutality of IS in Achin. They're not just fighting for money, they're fighting to protect their land and their loved ones. ALP started with help from the United States in 2010. The idea was to give locals a stake in their own security, particularly in areas where the government's security presence was weak.
We've picked up these guns to protect our women and children. We are not doing this for money or for a salary. The $100 or $150 we get per month is nothing. We can earn that doing anything else.
Today, the force operates in 31 of Afghanistan's 34 provinces and has become an important part of Afghanistan's security strategy. But while locals in Achin seem to be happy with their ALP unit, in many parts of Afghanistan it has faced accusations of human rights violations, abuse of power, and becoming a tool for the local strongmen. Afghanistan Independent Human Rights Commission says recruitment in the ALP is not always done according to protocol. Criminals, members of illegal armed groups, even the Taliban in some cases have managed to join the local force. The U.S. has made future funding for the force conditional on reforms. The Afghan government has taken some action, but human rights groups say much more is needed. Aisha Tanzim, VOA News, Achin, Nangarhar Province, Afghanistan.
Royal families around the world, from Britain to Jordan to Nepal, have given their time, attention, and resources to conservation efforts. Prince Albert II of Monaco has received numerous awards for his conservation work. VOA's Faith Lapidus found out he recently joined an Atlantic mission to save an endangered seal species.
Mediterranean monk seals are one of the most endangered marine mammals in the world. So-called because of their round bodies and heads that look hooded, there are only an estimated 600 to 700 left. The Desertus Islands in the Madeira Archipelago, southwest of Portugal, are home to a small colony of the seals and were the first destination for the Monaco Explorations Mission.
They came to Desertus to reproduce. There are some animals that they stay between Desertus, moving to Madeira. We found out also in the reproduction season, some males that usually are in Madeira, they come to Desertas. So Desertas is still being the most important place for the monk seals in Madeira.
Prince Albert II, a diving enthusiast, launched the explorations mission in April and joined it for the first leg of its journey as it headed out from Monaco last month. The goal of the 3-year-long mission is to expand understanding of the ocean's biodiversity.
But I think it's also, a natural curiosity about our seas and our oceans, and I want to learn more about them, and I want to help that people can appreciate them more and can know them better, because we only protect and and love what we know.
The three desertous islands have been a nature preserve since 1990. While the terrain is rocky and barren, the waters around them teem with life, including sperm whales and pilot whales. From here, the research vessel Yersin will head south to Cape Verde before crossing the Atlantic to the Caribbean and then head through the Panama Canal to the Pacific before returning to the Mediterranean in 2020. Along the way, the marine scientists on board will gather data on ocean warming and climate change. I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
We are happy you're with us here on VOA Asia Weekend. For the first time, a museum in Australia is telling the stories of the massacres by colonists of indigenous people from an Aboriginal perspective. It is thought thousands of First Nation people were murdered by white settlers up until the 1940s, but much of that history has yet to be uncovered. Phil Mercer had the story from Sydney.
Near the city of Portland is the site of the oldest known massacre of indigenous people in the Australian state of Victoria. There was tension in the early 1830s between European settlers who'd set up a whaling station and a local Aboriginal tribe over a whale carcass. The precise details of the confrontation have been hard to establish, but between 60 to 200 First Nation people were murdered in what's known as the Convincing Ground Massacre. The killings are part of a series of stories being told in a new exhibition at the Melbourne Museum. Called Black Day, Sun Rises, Blood Runs, the multimedia show is included in the museum's Bundjilica Aboriginal Cultural Centre. The stories are told by Indigenous people who've been filmed at the sites of several massacres. Officials say the testimony tries to fill gaps in the documentation of the killings contained in court proceedings, newspaper reports and Aboriginal records. Curator Genevieve Greaves says the exhibition contains valuable historical information.
We're going quite deeply into six narratives that include massacre, they include resistance, they include the native police who were used against Aboriginal people in Victoria and other parts of the country. And we're really doing that through first-person voice. So we're just talking to people connected to those spaces. And so we've got what's on the historical record, but also what's contained in memory as well, in Indigenous memory and indeed in non-Indigenous memory as well.
Greaves says this is the first time a new permanent exhibition at an Australian museum has detailed the stories of the massacres from an Indigenous perspective. According to the University of Newcastle in New South Wales, about 1,200 Indigenous people in Victoria State were murdered in 40 massacres from the 1830s to the 1850s. Academics say that armed white settlers or farmers would ambush Aboriginal camps in the night or early morning. In July, an online map marking the massacres of Aboriginal clans across Australia's colonial frontier was launched. It detailed more than 150 sites where violent attacks against Indigenous groups took place in eastern Australia following the arrival of European settlers in the late 1700s. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Another wearable health monitor is poised to enter the market. As VOA's Faith Lapidus reported, this one is on permanent watch for any signs of illness.
This may look like an ordinary watch, but it's not. The MAP Health Watch uses artificial intelligence, or AI, to constantly analyze the health of its wearer, offering an early warning system for medical emergencies.
There are clinical-grade, highly accurate sensors involved in this watch. There are five of them, which are determining vital signals and calculating other non-diagnostic parameters.
The sensors continually measure vital signs like blood pressure, heart rate, and skin temperature. The data is sent to the MAP Health Watch team to be evaluated by the AI and the medical staff. With a constant stream of data, the analysis should get better over time.
The longer the person wears this watch, longer the time the watch can adapt to its user, then the better alarm signals and less amount of false alarms and more specific alarms will be generated.
Five prototype watches are undergoing tests before mass production starts in China, and medical teams will be set up in the U.S. and Hungary. I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia Weekend. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Make sure to keep in touch with us 24 hours a day at voanews.com and on the VOA Asia Facebook page. And please be with us next week on VOA Asia Weekend.